Hey there, and thanks for tuning in for another On Science podcast, the weekly roundup of science coverage from NPR. I'm web producer Andrew Prince. We've got a mixed bag of stories for you this week, from a new study into, yes, whale dung, a conversation about the mental health of the rescued Chilean miners, and a nuclear road trip. But we're going to start off this week with bombs and brains. When players in the NFL suffer a concussion, they're often benched for a week or more. That's because until the brain heals, it's extremely vulnerable. Now, brain injury experts are trying to take this precautionary approach from the football field to the battlefield. NPR's John Hamilton reports that these experts have also made some surprising discoveries about how energy from an explosion reaches the brain and causes damage.
An enemy truck packed with artillery shells and gasoline caused Jake Mathers' first concussion in Iraq. Mathers was in a firefight near Ramadi when the truck blew up.
All I saw was sparks, and then I went out like a light, and I woke up and my nose was bleeding, my ears was bleeding, you know, like my tear ducts were bleeding.
Mathers' body was intact, though, so he stayed with his Marine unit and suffered another concussion.
No, there were several. RPG hit my truck one time. I got knocked out. But another time, we were going down this street called Ice Cream, probably the worst street in Ramadi, or one of them. And one of the guys shot an RPG and it hit the hood of our vehicle and blew up.
Mathers says he can't remember how many concussions he had during his seven-month tour. He has trouble remembering a lot of things now that he's back home in Monroe, Louisiana.
I'll lose my pack of smokes like three or four times a day, and I'll buy different packs of smokes because I forget, you know, that I bought them. Or sometimes I'm driving down the road, I forget where I'm going, or lose my car keys, cell phone.
Then there are the headaches, the nightmares, the problems sleeping. David Hovda directs the Brain Injury Research Center at UCLA. He says Iraq and Afghanistan have produced a lot of people like Mathers, people who had multiple concussions in a short period of time. He says each brain injury is usually the result of a relatively small explosion,
which, when it occurs close to an individual, can produce a concussive wave or a blast wave that actually moves the head and body very violently, and that can, in fact, cause a concussion.
And Hovda says brain scans show that for days or even weeks after an injury like this, the brain's metabolism slows down, which leaves some cells starved for energy.
During the time when this metabolism is altered, the brain not only is dysfunctional, but it's also extremely vulnerable, so that if it's exposed to another mild injury, which normally you would be able to tolerate really well, now there can be long-term devastating consequences.
It's the second hit, or the third, that often does the damage. So Hovda and others have been urging the military to act more like the NFL and order troops off the field when they've had a head injury. That message seems to be getting through. A few months ago, Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, announced a policy saying troops near a bomb blast must be removed from combat for 24 hours and must be checked for traumatic brain injury. Experts on brain injuries say implementing this policy is important for several reasons. Hovda says one is that concussions often cause fuzzy thinking.
If you're going to call in a mortar strike, you have to do some fancy math and some really sophisticated calculations in your head, and you could create a problem if this isn't done correctly.
Another reason to aggressively look for brain injury is that it's very hard to tell who might have sustained one. Ibolya Chernek studied brain injuries on the battlefields of Kosovo. Now she works at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland. She says research in animals shows that shock waves from a blast can cause brain damage even if the head is completely protected. The shock waves compress the abdomen or chest wall violently, she says, transferring the bomb's kinetic energy to blood and other fluids.
So this kinetic energy now inside the body generates oscillating pressure waves, which travel everywhere, to the organs, but also to the brain,
where they may kill or damage brain cells. Chernek says shockwaves also can reach structures deep in the brain that control things like blood pressure, balance, and speech. And she says the blast can cause a breach in the so-called blood-brain barrier, which usually protects the central nervous system from substances that could cause dangerous inflammation.
These inflammatory molecules and mechanisms start to give irreversible damages and changes in the brain, very comparable to Alzheimer's.
Repeated injuries in a short period of time greatly increase the risk that will happen. Jake Mathers, the Marine, says people probably ignored concussions until recently because they don't leave any visible scar.
It makes me a little mad, you know, people are like, oh, well, you seem fine. Well, you know, I'm not. And, yeah, you know, it's not like I'm missing a leg, but I'm missing something that I can never get back.
Mather says he hopes his story will help protect the next generation of fighters. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Traumatic brain injuries have been the subject of investigation by our reporting partner ProPublica, and you can find all of our coverage about TBIs at our website, npr.org/brainwars. Wales may have a new group of cheerleaders. They've always been popular with the environmental crowd, but new findings suggest that the fishing industry may also want to adopt the slogan, Save the Whales. NPR's Joe Palka explains.
This is a story about whales, but it's also a story about nitrogen and algae and fish, and I'm afraid I have to say this, poop. Let's start with algae. Algae range in size from single-celled organisms to giant kelp plants. The ones we're talking about today live near the surface of the ocean. These algae need nitrogen to grow.
They need other nutrients as well, but in the system we looked at, the limiting nutrient tends to be nitrogen. That's the first thing that they use up.
Joe Roman is a conservation biologist at the University of Vermont. The system he was studying was the Gulf of Maine. Roman says once the algae use up the nitrogen, eventually they die and sink to the bottom, taking the nitrogen with them. Sometimes fish eat the algae, but then they poop, and the nitrogen sinks to the bottom in the fish poop. One way or another, it's a one-way elevator down.
Whales, on the other hand, often feed at depth. So they feed low in the water column, and they're consistently seen pooping at the surface.
How does Roman know whales poop at the surface? Because he went out and watched.
And we were following the whales and collecting feces whenever there was poop at the surface.
And the difference between whale poop and fish poop is that whale poop tends to float, or at least stay near the surface. This is significant because when Roman took the whale poop back to his lab, he found it was rich in nitrogen. So the whales were bringing that essential nutrient that had sunk to the bottom back to the surface.
So essentially, by defecating at the surface, they're fertilizing their own areas where they're feeding.
Not only more algae,
but also an increased number of fish.
Because fish thrive on algae. Roman says the finding that whales may be helping to feed their fishy friends comes as something of a surprise.
Often whales were seen as, by some communities, are seen as competitors. Here we're showing that whales can actually provide a service.
This isn't the first time scientists have suspected that whales and large fish play a role in moving nutrients from one part of the ocean to another. Andrew Pershing is a research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and the University of Maine.
The real question is whether this is a net gain in the system, or what the whales are doing is really just speeding up the cycling.
Winds or storms can move nutrients from the bottom of the ocean to the surface. Nobody knows yet how much of a difference the whales really make.
It's a lot like an accounting problem. You know, are you just sort of trading money around within your local economy, or is there actually a net increase in the GDP?
In this case, it's not money we're talking about, but poop. Well, okay, nitrogen if you want to get technical. Pershing says Roman's work is bound to get scientists thinking more about the role of large marine mammals in ocean ecosystems.
I think it's a really valuable study. And then because there's poop involved, it's a great way of connecting the public, or at least to the 5-year-olds out there.
He's probably right about that. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
On October 11th, a shipment of bomb-grade uranium arrived at a secure facility in Russia. It came from a nuclear research reactor in Poland, part of a race to secure dangerous radioactive material around the world. Reporter Jeff Brumfield was in Poland 2 weeks earlier when the uranium left the reactor, and he sent this report.
There's no way that you'd mistake this for a shipment of, say, Polish sausages. For one thing, the trucks are escorted by dozens of heavily armed police officers. And if that didn't clue you in, the big radioactive signs would.
I feel like we prepared for everything, but you're just a little bit nervous.
Igor Bolshinsky is part of a small American team that's planned this nuclear road trip. They're moving uranium from Poland back to Russia, where it came from in the first place. The route's complicated. The material will travel by truck to Warsaw, by train to the Baltic port of Gdynia, by boat to the Russian port of Murmansk, and by train again to a high-security facility in Siberia.
We'll good luck. So we'll see you in 2 hours.
In terminal,
yeah. Good luck.
The uranium was never intended for weapons. It was fuel for a small nuclear reactor that scientists use for research. Globally, there are over 100 research reactors like this one. Matthew Bunn is an expert on nuclear security at Harvard University.
Most of them were supplied either by the United States or the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and they do all kinds of different work, ranging from training students to even interesting archaeology and medical research.
These reactors are using highly enriched uranium fuel pure enough for a bomb. Since September 11th, the U.S. government has grown increasingly worried that terrorists could steal this material or buy it. Bunn says that these reactors aren't very well guarded.
They're just not places where it's plausible that you're ever going to have the kinds of, you know, military-scale security that are really, in my view, appropriate.
The solution? Convert the reactor to run on low-enriched uranium that can't be used in a bomb, then transport the dangerous stuff back to where it came from, in this case, Russia. Sounds simple enough, right? Well, guess again.
There's a lot of work at the diplomatic and the technical level. You have people from the Ministry of Economy. You have the director of the reactor.
Andrew Binyavsky is the guy in charge of the U.S. program. He says that just moving the fuel from this one reactor took 3 years.
You have coordination with the U.S. embassy here. You have coordination with the police and the special forces.
In April of last year, President Obama set a goal of securing all vulnerable nuclear material in just 4 years. Not every dangerous research reactor can be converted by then, but Binyavsky is hoping to clear out 10 countries. As we stand by the train waiting for shipping documents to be signed, even that goal seems ambitious.
It's an aggressive schedule.
Given that we're standing in a rail yard waiting to leave.
Yeah, I mean, it is an aggressive schedule, but I do think that we can make it.
Eventually, the train does get moving, and the global program is moving ahead, too. In the past 3 years, Binyavsky's team has shut down or converted 24 reactors in places like China, Bulgaria, Chile, and the United States, which still has several reactors running on bomb-grade fuel. But there's one place the U.S. effort has barely reached. Here's Harvard's Matthew Bunn.
One of the biggest and most difficult stumbling blocks at this point is Russia, frankly. They've been willing to be helpful on converting the reactors that they supply in other countries. But in converting their own, which is the world's largest number of research reactors, they've been moving extraordinarily slowly.
But the U.S. needs to tread carefully. Russian cooperation is essential for operations like this one in Poland. In fact, it's a Russian ship that will take the fuel on the next leg of its journey. One by one, containers are lowered into the hold, then covered with heavy plates that will shield the crew from radiation. After a final check from customs authorities, the boat pulls away from the port. And the Americans, the Poles, and Russians all gather dockside to celebrate with a toast.
We have developed a special saying, and it is «Невозможно, возможно».
Это невозможно, возможно.
The impossible is possible. Cheers.
Cheers.
Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
We'll end with the most dramatic event of this past week, the successful rescue of the 33 Chilean miners who were trapped underground for more than 2 months. It was hard to miss the wall-to-wall coverage of the rescue, on TV and online, as each of the miners was hauled to the surface in a specially made capsule from half a mile down. Dr. Albert Holland is a psychologist for NASA. The Chilean government brought him down to the mine site last month for advice on how to keep the miners mentally healthy while they were trapped. He spoke to All Things Considered host Melissa Block from the Johnson Space Center in Houston during the rescue.
Welcome to the program.
Hi, Melissa.
You know, people seem to be worried about maybe a traumatic initial re-entry for the miners above ground. Seems to be anything but that. We're seeing nothing but pure joy.
Well, there's pure joy, and that should be the primary component, understandably. But I think there's some concern that once the adrenaline wears off and the notoriety wears off, that maybe things will go south a little bit.
And what might happen? What would you be prepared for there?
Well, I think that for the most part, adaptation. Everybody's going to have to do it, the family members, the minors, even the topside personnel, as this thing wears off. But one consideration, of course, is making sure that there are no lasting repercussions from their confinement down there. So that I'm sure the physicians down there are looking for any signs of anxiety reactions or depression or even PTSD.
And you talked about the adrenaline wearing off. I suppose part of that would be the social bonds that were created down there. Once those dissolve, what replaces them?
It appears that the social bonds were considerable. There was a great deal of cohesion within this group. But there will be a lot of pressures on these fellows as time goes by, because now they're going off to different environments, different opportunities, different stressors. The families have different pressures and different desires, and there may be some drift. And I think some of them will want to stay in touch and get back together. And then others maybe will be okay with that. And they'll maybe say, this is just as it is, and I'm okay with seeing them less often or perhaps never again.
You know, I remember hearing midway through this ordeal of a moment when the miners had started getting food from above ground, and there was a point at which they sent some of the food back. I think it was peaches, and they decided they didn't want them, and they sent them back. And I was wondering whether, from a psychological point of view, that's a really good sign.
It actually is. And I was really pleased to hear that when I did hear that. I thought, okay, these guys are in pretty good shape. It showed that they were engaged with the topside, and they were thinking beyond survival. Because initially, that's what they were only thinking about was survival. And now they had a topside and someone they could grouse at. And frankly, that's sometimes the role of topside.
I wonder if you've stopped to think about the frame of mind of the very last miner who will come up. I guess it's the group's leader, Luis Urzúa, thinking about what would be going through his mind, having watched all of his colleagues going up one by one.
This is very appropriate, I think, and is telling about his leadership. It's like being the captain who is the last person off the ship, and I think that fits. That fits. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about him. I think he's an interesting person.
Well, Dr. Holland, thanks so much.
You bet.
That's Dr. Albert Holland. He's a psychologist for NASA who was brought in by the Chilean government to advise on keeping the miners mentally healthy. He joined us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston.
That wraps up this week's On Science podcast from NPR. Head over to our website, npr.org/science, where you'll find all of NPR science coverage. I'm Andrew Prince. Have a great week.